Widerian Resistance Radio calling. Widerian Resistance Radio calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy in the Bunker here in North Central Indiana on a sunshiny. I don't think there's hardly any clouds in the sky today. This is the 5th of November, 2014, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Yeah, it's going to be a nice one today. I don't think, probably up in the 60s, so anyhow, that's good weather to move around back here in the Midwest. Well, I sort of took a swing around the radio and television bands this morning and listened to the Republicans gloat and brag and scream about victory, and then I tuned in and listened to the Democrats all crying in their beer. It's all the same shit as far as I'm concerned. And the games go on, you know, like they said in the Coliseum, let the games restart. No, they never finished. Well, I wonder what the next crisis is. Do you remember going back a few crises? I mean, these crises come and go. You should number them and write them down, because I can't keep track of them anymore. They come, they go, they peek out, they scream and yell, and then they're gone. And the people say, oh, I'm not afraid anymore until the next crisis. Well, let's play back a little MP3 I created just about an hour ago for you.
Well, I see somebody has been using my name in vain again. I got a note here on Religion Online today, and it had to do with Michael Hoffman, who is a I have known of Michael Hoffman for a long time. He used to work for a short time on our newspaper, the War newspaper, and a couple of other projects. But you got to understand, Michael Hoffman is a committed Christian, and he sees everything from a religious point of view, or maybe not everything, but most things. And he's written a new book, I guess, called Judaism's Strange Gods by Michael Hoffman. Well, he's just as much, he's into Christ Insanity, which is pretty much Jewish. Certainly the Old Testament is, and I say the New Testament is too. And this guy put a note on this chat board. He said, Hoffman has worked on projects of neo-Nazi Tom Metzger, you know. See, neo-Nazi means nothing to me. Either I'm a National Socialist or I'm not a National Socialist. That's, of course, neo-Nazi is a Jewish way of saying things and going after somebody. But I don't care anymore. They call me everything. And he's also has been connected with Holocaust deniers Willis Carto. I don't think anybody in this Holocaust discussion denies that there weren't a lot of Jews died. All we're arguing about is how many died and for what reasons. I don't think Willis Carto or any of these guys, even though I may not get along with some of these guys, I don't think any of them have ever said that there weren't large numbers of Jews that died, but of course they never say much about 55 million people who died, most of them non-Jewish. Anyhow, I suppose he's worked with David Irving, you know, and Ernst Zundel and Herman Otten. Considering the conspiratorial topics of this year's submissions, it is no surprise that the APFF, whatever that is, has attracted interest from anti-Semites. Well, I'm anti-Jewish in a lot of ways. Not every Jew, of course. I'm not an anti-Semite because I'm not anti-Arab. I want to leave them alone and let them worship whatever crazy religion they worship. It's not any crazier than Christianity, that's for sure. And for anti-Semites from outside Iran, including American anti-Semites. See, those kinds of terms are invented by pro-Jewish people. to shut off all discussions. The minute they say he's an anti-Semite, everybody stops listening to him. The minute they say he's a neo-Nazi, everybody stops listening to him. And that's the way that works. It's really ingenious the way they make that work. And also says about the Holocaust denier Michael Hoffman, editor of the Conspiratorial Veterans Today, Gordon Duff, I've never heard of him, the frequent press TV contributor Mark Glenn, I've heard of him, American anti-Semites, stop listening to him, he's an anti-Semite, have been frequent participants in anti-Semitic and Holocaust denying conferences in Iran. You see the way they do that? Often under the guise of promoting cultural and academic understanding. Well, in reality, they are trying to get to the basis of truth. And if you would debate it like normal debate would go, it wouldn't be a big problem. The foremost distorters of Talmudic texts include David Duke, the former Klansman. Duke will never get out of the Klan, neither will I. Even though that's, what, 30-some years ago. And white supremacist, and Michael A. Hoffman II, a conspiracy theorist and Holocaust denier. See, all the terms are repeated over and over and over again, so anybody who reads this immediately tends to shut off anything any of these people, including myself, say. That's the way it works, and that's the way they do it, and that is a very effective way of doing it. You need to develop labels like this, too. I haven't thought of any really good ones lately, but I'm sure you can. Anyhow, that's from Theology Online, you know. Theology. Yeah, man, the study of spooks in the sky.
Well, just how anti-Semitic was FDR? Let's check it out. As the 76th anniversary of Kristallnacht is marked with solemn ceremonies at synagogues around the country this week, a new film and book are hailing President Franklin D. Roosevelt's response to the program as forceful and impressive. But a long-forgotten diary entry by a Roosevelt cabinet member tells a different story. On the night of November 9th and 10th, 1938, gee, that was about 4 months after I was born, the Nazis unleashed a nationwide program against the German Jews. Hundreds of synagogues were torched. I don't believe that. The windows of thousands of Jewish businesses were smashed. That's an exaggeration. 100 Jews were murdered, maybe for different reasons, and 30,000 more were dragged off to concentration camps. Again, exaggeration. Anyhow, the recent Ken Burns PBS documentary, The Roosevelts, and its coffee table companion book emphasizes that President Roosevelt sharply condemned the program. Quote, ordered the visas of 15,000 Germans and Austrian resident aliens extended, and recalled his ambassador from Berlin, something neither Britain nor France dared to do. Likewise, Richard Breitman and Alan Lichtman, in their recent book FDR and the Jews, praised the president's humanitarian impulse in acting on his own inclinations with little support from his foreign policy team or the Congress. Actually, President Roosevelt's steps in response to Kristallnacht were conceived and proposed by members of his team, not by FDR himself. And, of course, there were several Jews on his team. Let's see. 5 days after receiving a telegram from Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, Roosevelt's most prominent supporter in the Jewish community, that community thing gets overused, I think. Alerting him to the pogrom was far worse than you know. The president finally issued a public condemnation. Well, as I recall, Hitler himself condemned it. That it's sort of one of those street things that got out of hand. The condemnation was just four sentences long. The president did not mention either the Hitler regime or its Jewish victims. He said that the news of the past few days from Germany had shocked public opinion, and he could scarcely believe that such things would occur in the 20th century civilization. Well, hell, they've happened all over the world all the time, whether it's in the 21st century or not. Riots and breaking windows. Did anybody ever hear of Chicago and the Negroes? The idea of asking the U.S. ambassador in Berlin to come back to Washington to report to President Roosevelt was suggested by Assistant Secretary of State George Messerschmitt. He warned the president that without such a step, America would fall behind in public opinion and lose prestige throughout the world. You see, that's something that's bullshit, trying to impress people around the world and make them like you and all that kind of crap. Exactly as Messerschmitt recommended, FDR emphasized that he was calling the ambassador home for consultation. What kind of lies can we dig up? There was no suspension or severance of U.S. relations with National Socialist Germany, or is it National Capitalist Germany? People are still making lots of money on both sides. You forget about that. The idea of extending the visitor's visa of German citizens, most of them Jews, in the United States, originated in a proposal by Secretary of Labor Francis Perkins, along with Advocate for Refugees. Secretary Perkins actually urged even wider use of the visitor visas for Jews, obviously. She proposed granting visitor visas to would-be German Jewish immigrants in general as a way of getting around the excessive restrictions that American consular officials in Germany were using to disqualify potential immigrants that they do for other people around the world. What's new? But Roosevelt would have none of that, extending the visitors' visas of the 15,000 German citizens who were already in the U.S. was an easy way to appear humanitarian without permitting a single additional refugee to enter the country. 6 months later, the refugee ship St. Louis was hovering anxiously off America's shore. Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau Jr. proposed admitting the passengers to a U.S. territory, the Virgin Islands, on visitors' visas. Secretary of State Cordell Hull, with the president's backing, shot down that proposal on the grounds that technically a visitor's visa could be issued only to someone who had a valid return address to which he or she would return. Yet that technicality had not been an obstacle when the president wanted to make his post-Kristallnacht gesture. Contemporary defenders of FDR's response to Kristallnacht are correct when they note that Britain and France, unlike Roosevelt, did not recall their ambassadors from Berlin for consultations. But the British government took concrete steps that were much more significant than a symbolic diplomatic consultation. It admitted 10,000 German Jewish refugee children, the famous Kinder Transport, and granted them haven to 14,000 young German Jewish women by admitting them as cooks and nannies. By contrast, President Roosevelt refused to endorse post-Kristallnacht legislation, the Wagner-Rogers bill, that would have admitted 20,000 German Jewish children. An entry in the private diary of Interior Secretary Harold Ickes, published in 1954, sheds light on FDR's basic attitude. Ickes had been invited to participate in a post-Kristallnacht broadcast on CBS radio. As was customary, he submitted the draft of his speech to the White House. Quote, The draft is submitted and was approved, unquote, Ickes wrote in his diary, except that the president wanted us to cut out all references to Germany by name, as well as references to Hitler, Goebbels, and others by name. Despite the program, despite everything else Hitler regime had done to the Jews, President Roosevelt was still anxious to avoid criticizing any Nazi leaders by name so as not to harm America's relation with Nazi Germany. Whoa. And I say to you that that was not because he had any sympathy with Nazi Germany, but it was about money. There was still all kinds of trade between the capitalists going on. GM had plants in Germany, incidentally, that were not bombed during the war. There was all kinds of other capitalist goings-on between the two countries. 3 weeks later, FDR censored Ickes again when the Interior Secretary showed the White House a speech he planned to give to a Jewish audience in Cleveland in early December. He was ordered to delete a sentence on welcoming the refugees that said, quote, "Perhaps it is too much to hope that America in time can or will return to its former noble historic policy," unquote. For the Roosevelt administration, a return to that noble policy was indeed too much to hope for or even mention. Well, what do you think about that? Things weren't all love and peaches. Anyhow, when you read this kind of stuff, you got to understand that it was economics, follow the buck. Yeah, sure, there was some empathy going on, but the major reasons for U.S. policy and Britain's policy and so forth had to do with money, capitalist money, pure and simple. Now let's see what they're doing over in Brussels, Belgium, about the horrible scourge of racist talk. A little over a year after a French court forced Twitter to remove some anti-Semitic content, experts say the ruling has had a ripple effect, leading other internet companies to act more aggressively against hate speech in an effort to avoid lawsuits. There's another way the Jews and their buddies work it. Any speech they don't like, especially if it criticizes Israel, the Jews, is automatically hate speech. That's how hate speech, the whole label, all came about. They didn't care about other hate speech, but they threw it all into one big basket so that they could say, "Wait, wait a minute, we didn't come up with that hate speech just because of the Jewish situation. It had to do with all this stuff of people attacking other people or criticizing other people or other countries." In 2013, ruling by the Paris Court of Appeals settled a lawsuit brought the year before by the Union of Jewish Students of France over hashtag UnBonJuif, which means a good Jew, in which was used to index thousands of anti-Semitic comments that violated France's law against hate speech that was purely designed for the Jews, no matter what any bullshit progressive tells you different. Since then, YouTube was has permanently banned videos posted by Diadoni, a French black comedian with 10 convictions for inciting racial hatred against the Jews. Well, don't feel bad there, Mr. Black Man, Mr. Anti-Semitic Black Man. They banned me. They banned my material. At least banned me. I can't have an account on YouTube. Facebook removed the page of French Holocaust denier, Alien Sorrel. Why don't they say a intellectual guy that disagrees with the number of these people killed? Somehow I got a speaking ad come up here, and I think it might be getting through to you on this recording. So it's gone now. It's the way they try to sneak stuff in on you. See? That's anti-Semitic. Quote, big companies, follow the money, don't want to be sued, unquote, said Konstantinos Kamateas. There's that damn voice again. How do I get rid of that? I hope you're not hearing that. That would be a tragedy. Well, I'm just going to continue, hoping that that audio is not feeding through from the ad. Anyhow, the change comes amid a string of heavy sentences handed down by European courts against individuals who use online platforms to incite, keyword, incite to racism or violence. Well, number one, there's absolutely nothing wrong with racism. Racism is the act of trying to protect your race and advocating your race and advocating racial separation and so forth. And to incite, see how they use those words? Incite. In other words, you are... You incite. That's what they said about me in Portland. I incited these skinheads to beat up and kill a guy, which was totally ridiculous. And or violence, they say. You see, this is the way they twist the words around and use the words, not only to get to you, but to turn people around you against you, so they won't listen to you about important things. On Monday, a British court sentenced one such offender to 4 weeks in jail for tweeting, quote, Hitler was right, unquote, which, you know, is simply an opinion to a Jewish lawmaker. Oh, he said it to a Jewish lawmaker. In other words, Jewish lawmakers are above everything, right? Last week in court in Geneva, sentenced a man to 5 months in jail for posting text that denied the Holocaust. And in April, a French court sentenced two men to 5 months in jail for posting an anti-Semitic video. Well, let me tell you, boys and girls, this works in our favor. The more you jail people and punish them and deprive them of free speech and everything else, the more they're inclined to hate. You know, guys that just start out as a simple research of the facts, after they're called all kinds of names and thrown into prison, what do you think's going to happen? Because they're going to talk with other people in the prison and so forth. They're going to come back hating everybody, man. Let me get my hands on a Jew, man. Before I was pretty peaceful, but now I hate their guts. Well, that's what happens. I wonder how many people who may have committed excesses against the Jews in Germany during World War II and prior to World War II had been persecuted viciously by the Jews, who Germany's courts were full of Jew judges and Jews on the juries and so forth. You know, did you ever ask yourself that? And then they finally got a chance to get even, you know. I noticed, too, they're always saying how the Nazis took over and robbed everybody of their art. Well, who did the Jews rob the art from? In many cases, after World War I, when Germany was totally on its ass, the Jews were able to buy up fine art from people who'd lost their fortunes for pennies on the dollar. So the Jews Germans started taking them back during and before the war. Anyhow, the stiffer sentences owe partly to a realization by judges of the dangers imposed on online hatred. Well, I don't think they realize just the opposite, that you are promoting more hatred. I know with me, I started out as just a little sort of a conservative kind of guy. I didn't really have an axe to grind except with communism. And every step along the way, as I took persecution after persecution, I became more strident and became an anti-government hater and all that stuff. And then they started, when they started calling me names, calling me racist. Well, at the time I wasn't a racist. So pretty soon I got to say, well, fuck you, I am a racist now. Same way with the Jews. If you criticize the over preponderance of Jews in the finance world and international banking, which is absolutely true, you're an anti-Semite, Metzger. And so the more they said that, finally I said, hell yes, man, I'm an anti-Semite. Anti-Jew. Also, in light of cyber jihadism, you see there, you can tell where this is coming from and how it affected people like Muhammad Murrah, unquote, said Christopher Glossens, the legal advisor to the Belgium League Against Anti-Semitism, referred to the killer of four Jews at a Jewish school in Toulouse in 2012. In the Twitter case, the company argued that as an American firm, it was protected by the First Amendment. But the court rejected the argument and forced Twitter to remove some of the comments and identify some of the authors. It is also required that the company to set up a system of flagging and ultimately removing comments that violate hate speech laws, which is going to cause more hatred. More and more left-wing kids are beginning to hate the Jews, or at least hate the leadership of the Jews and their influence on free speech. Twitter responded by overhauling its terms of service to facilitate adherence to European law. In other words, to kiss their ass because of money. Twitter's head of global safety outreach and public policy, Patricia Cartes-Andres, revealed Monday at the conference in Brussels organized by the International Network Against Cyber Hate. The rules have been changed in a way that allows the U.S. to take down more content when groups are being targeted. What do you mean, criticized? Targeted for what? There's a lot of difference between targeting someone for a violent act or targeting them to criticize them, in many cases, for telling the truth. Before the lawsuit, she added, if you didn't target any one person, you could have gotten away with it. Oh, in other words, you can't criticize... wait a minute, how did that read? If you didn't target any one person, you could have gotten away with it. Well, it's a lot like that here now. I mean, you know, generally you can criticize groups or political movements or whatever, but a lot of times they go after you if you target an individual. You see, that's what the problem Matt Hale got in up there in Chicago. Instead of, like I said, all federal judges are assholes and need to be tried and hung by the neck until dead, he got personal with one judge, and that led to alleged conspiracy that was headed up by his chief of security to hang him. So now he's in there doing 40 years when he should have been. He should have said all these federal judges across the country are goddamn rats, like Jefferson said. Supreme Court is simply nine old men that can say anything means anything. They can rule anything means anything, which is about the same thing. So it's, you got to just, and it's true. It's not just one judge, you know, where you put a name on it. It's all the goddamn federal judges. They're nothing but last resort or first resort protectors of the system, not to protect you. That's what they're there for, to protect the system. And they got them all over the country. What, 12 districts? Suzette Bronk, and also they're there to stop any initiatives that are passed on at the state level. That if in California you can get enough signatures, you can get an initiative on the ballot. But every time you do and it goes our way, or even sometimes other people's ways that we might not agree with, they get one federal judge and they knock it out. So you got, a million people vote for something and then one person knocks it out. Oh, that's democracy. That's plain old autocracy. Suzette Bronkhorst, secretary of the INACH, another one of these asshole outfits, said Twitter's adjusted policies are part of a change in attitude by online service providers. Well, I say this, don't use Twitter. Why do you need Twitter? A lot of this stuff you don't even need, so screw them. Quote, before the trial, Twitter gave Europe the middle finger, which was good at the time. But they realized that if they want to work in Europe, they need to keep European laws, and others are coming in the same realization. Well, Twitter's making plenty of money in the United States and other countries where it's totally legal, so why didn't they just continue to give the finger to Europe again? Here you go. It's greed. It all comes down to money and greed. Well, you're not going to make as much money if you do that. So First Amendment goes out the window. According to Kamaptidis, the Twitter case was built on a landmark court ruling in 2000 that forced the search engine of Yahoo to ban the sale of Nazi memorabilia. Well, why wouldn't it be World War II military memorabilia? Yeah. But the 2013 ruling went much further, he said, demonstrating the increased pressure of providers to adhere to national laws, unmask offenders, and set up flagging mechanisms only for the interests of the Jews and international Jewry, benign-breath bastards. Why do I hate the Jewish thing? It's all right there. Still, the INACH conference showed that big gaps remain between the practices sought by European anti-racism activists and those now being implemented by tech companies. Well, they realize you're never going to get rid of racism because racism is natural. Anti-racism is unnatural. One area of contention is Holocaust denial, which is illegal in many European countries. Now, why would they have those laws? You think they're all promoted by the Gentiles? Well, of course not. It's simply Jewish. But which several American companies reflecting the broader free speech protections prevalent in the United States are refusing to censure. Delphine Rear, Facebook's director of policy, said at the conference that the company believes users should be allowed to debate the subject. Well, that's good. Counter speech is a powerful tool and we lose with censorship, she said. Cartres Andrus cited the example of hashtag Putos Judios, Spanish for Jewish whores, which in May drew thousands of comments after a Spanish basketball team lost to its Israeli rival. More than 90% of the comments were positive statements that attacked those who used the offensive term. So, big deal. I'm offended. You call me an Israeli whore. Well, if you are, wear it. Some of the comments are subject to ongoing police investigation in Spain, launched after a complaint filed by 11 Jewish groups. Oh, you know, I always thought that the reason I came to not liking Jews was because they invented Christianity, the biggest crime against the white race. But now there's other reasons. But Mark Gardner of Britain's Community Security Trust wasn't buying it. Quote, there's no counter speech to Holocaust denial, Gardner said at the conference. I'm not going to send Holocaust survivors to debate the existence of Auschwitz online. That's ridiculous. We'll just cut off all free speech. And then the Jews will love us. Oh, boy. You're never going to defeat National Socialism as long as these Jews are around, I'll tell you that. Well, what do you think of this? A Canadian-born Orthodox Jew by the name of Nick Muzin, M-U-Z-I-N, helps boost black GOP Senator Tim Scott to prominence. Do you hear any conservative right-wing guys on the radio objecting to this? On a Saturday night following Shabbat, Nick Muzin arrays on his dining room table what would turn out to be the winning strategy to elect the first black Republican to Congress from South Carolina in more than a century. The next night, on the same table in his Charleston, South Carolina home, Muzin hosts his weekly Talmud class. Associates say that the duality typifies Muzin, the 37-year-old Orthodox Jewish dynamo now leading the effort by House Republicans to expand the party's appeal following Mitt Romney's loss to President Obama last November. So you see, don't look to the Republican Party to save your ass. I'll tell you that. I tell you that all the time. They're even worse. The ascension of Tim Scott from the South Carolina State House to the U.S. House of Representatives and last December to the U.S. Senate is relatively well known. Boy, he's a black as ace of spades. The first elected to the House in 2010 as a leader of the Tea Party. Scott won re-election last November before being tapped just a few weeks later by Governor Nikki Haley to fill the seat vacated by retiring Senator Jim DeMint. Scott's quick ascendance, the rarity of his being a black Republican, and his Tea Party stature has earned him national attention. Oh, you don't think it was planned from the very beginning? Less well known is the role of Muzin, the Montreal-born doctor, lawyer, and Jewish scholar, who has been instrumental in paving Scott's way. Muzin, who is a naturalized American, I wouldn't call him a naturalized, was a policy advisor on Scott's 2010 campaign until December was his chief of staff. Though Muzin now is director of strategy and coalition to the House Republican Conference, he also has a role in Scott's fundraising political action committee. See, this is all Jewish bullshit, right at the top, all the way through the Republican Party. The close alliance and friendship between the black Tea Party Republican from the South and Orthodox Jewish doctor lawyer from Canada is a rarity in politics and upends perceptions about how blacks and Jews interact, Muzin and Scott say. Scott, 47, first to credit Muzin for his success. Without Muzin's entries into that Saturday night in January 2010, Scott would not have run for the Charleston area House seat that opened with the retirement of Representative Henry Brown. Initially, I was fairly reluctant. I did not have my sights set on Washington, Scott said. He was crucial in helping me get to that conclusion, the Jew. Scott instead had his eye on a state lieutenant governorship, which is what first drew the men together in 2009. The lieutenant governor overseeing the state's Office of Aging and Muzin, a lawyer with a medical degree from Yeshiva University, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, was interested in a health policy. So Muzin sought out Scott, and the two bonded over policy, a curiosity about each other's belief. Oh, isn't that nice? He'd be studying the Bible all the time in his office. That's the nigger. And we would talk regularly about what I was learning at Daf Yomi every day, Muzi said of Scott. Daf Yomi is the page-a-day Talmud study program. He had a real appreciation for Jewish people and for religious people. The appreciation became evident early in the campaign when Scott told Muzin he wanted to release a statement that on May 2010 clashed between Israeli commandos and Gazi-bound flotilla that left 9 Turkish nationals dead. Quote, I want to go on record as saying that Israel was within its rights to murder these people in international maritime law to intercept the flotilla since Hamas, a terrorist organization, you see. No matter what you say, if you're critical of Israel, you're a terrorist. Has sworn to annihilate the Jewish people, blah, 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 and regularly transfers weapons to Gaza. And Scott, at the time, was a House candidate in a state where Jewish vote barely registers. Well, you see, that flotilla was all food and clothing and other things. It was not weapons. So the niggers all for killing them. The notion of an African-American Negro Republican from the South making Israel a focus, as Scott has throughout his congressional career, has even become a target of writers on Saturday Night Live in a skit over the weekend that didn't make the final cut for the show. Cast member Kenan Thompson plays Scott, grilling Defense Secretary nominee Chuck Hagel on his fealty to Israel. Quote, as an African-American Republican from South Carolina, love of Israel is in my blood, quote, Thompson said to audience titters. In Muzin's case, his political trajectory baffles even some of his friends. In 2000, he rallied the Gore-Lieberman ticket. But in 2004, he told the Yale Daily News that encounters with liberals at Yale had driven him rightward. What's the difference? I find that the student body here is ultra-liberal and extremely intolerant. In other words, they see crimes against the Palestinian people. Muzin, then president of Yale's Conservative Federalist Society, told a campus paper. Muzin joined George W. Bush's 2004 re-election campaign as a counsel for the Republican National Committee and served as its medical advisor for the 2008 presidential campaign of Senator John McCain. Yeah, there we go. In 2006, while working in Washington as an attorney defending physicians and pharmaceutical companies, Muzin began seeing the scion of a prominent Charleston family, Andrea Zucker. Oh. Within months after a surprise proposal in Jerusalem during a trip to Israel, the two were married. You know, they love to marry into rich WASP families. Yeah. People thought we were crazy, Zucker told Charleston Wedding Magazine. Zucker's father, Jerry, was a Forbes 400 billionaire who owned, among other properties, the Canadian retail giant Hudson's Bay Company. It's getting interesting, huh? See how this works? The Muzins moved to Charleston to help out with the family business. My wife bought me a tourist guide to the South, Muzin said. She said, see, this is an extended adventure. I kind of embrace it. I bought a truck, a King Ranch F-150 Ford. I got into boating. I started training to compete in triathlons. The truck surprised friends. I didn't need it for any reason whatever, Muzin said, laughing. No, I want to look like the good old boys, right? He practiced medicine a day a week at a free clinic and started hosting weekly Talmud classes. In 2010, with Obama's health care reform about to pass, Muzin again turned to the medical policy. He sensed that Scott, the success story son of a single mother, would be an effective spokesman against Obamacare. He came over to my house on Matzal Shabbos, and I laid out a memo and said, if you decide to run, these are the issues. Muzin recalled that Saturday night. Scott was won over by Jew Muzin, was soon running his campaign. Scott quickly won the endorsement of DeMint, Republican, and Representative Eric Cantor, Jew Republican, who was set then to become House Majority Leader. Scott won the fundraising battle with his most serious challenge, Paul Thurman, the son of the late Strom Thurmond, and primary race before trouncing his Democratic challenger in the general election. Muzin became Scott's chief of staff and moved back to Washington, family in tow. He now has three children. He has sold the Ford truck, served his purpose. Since December, Muzin has been leading the Republican outreach to groups that rejected the party in the last election, noting mestizo voters, young libertarian voters, women, Asians, African Americans. Boy, he's really getting in there. Republicans are debating whether the party's messaging or more fundamental policy changes are needed on such matters as entitlement, spending, immigration, gay marriage. Muzin is focused more on the message. Quote, our job in the Republican conference is to tell people to stop talking about rape, Muzin quips, referring to candidates in the last November's election who advocated against abortion even in the cases of rape and incest. We have to figure out who's our best communicators are and get them on TV instead of people we don't want to represent us. Oh, see how that works? People who disagree, Republicans who disagree. If anyone can pull this off, it's Muzin the Jew, said Noah Silverman, the Congressional Affairs Director of the Republican Jewish Coalition. He's someone who has a natural ability to think in terms of questions that might be on the minds of non-traditional Republican constituencies, Silverman said. Yeah, right. Political rivals credit Muzin with a smooth, soft pitch. Well, that's the way Jews do it. We don't agree on policy at all, but he's a minch, said Tom Kahn, the top Republican or Democratic staffer on a House Budget Committee. Quote, he is able to hold strong views and to disagree strongly, but to do it in a very agreeable Jewish way. Rabbi Levi Shemtov, director of American Friends of Lubavitch, who has known Muzin since his Washington days, says his biography is an example of community outreach. It's pretty obvious that Nick could have done practically anything he wanted in terms of his education, opportunity, and background, Shemtov said. But instead, he's working behind the scenes with the B'nai B'rith to screw America, and specifically screw the Aryan people. Stuart Feldman, a family friend who was part of the Charleston Talmud class and became a Muzin confidant, said that's the key to Muzin's leadership. He never makes anyone feel slighted, Feldman said. Well, he makes me feel slighted. Yeah, there's another hero of the Tea Party, that so-called party that a lot of white nationalists, they like that Tea Party. Shit. They got the two brothers there, the Koch brothers, billionaires, funding the operations, and they got Jews in there training people of all colors to become Republicans. I don't know, should you cry or laugh? I choose to laugh because all this bullshit's going to come down around their ears sooner or later. You can't hold it together. You can't hold this shit together. In history, it's never happened before. Except, you know, maybe for a few decades. Well, that was sort of a long one, but I think you need it. I think it's good for you to understand how deep the rot is and how there's nothing the Republicans or Democrats or Christianity or any of these people can do to dig themselves out of this shit as our main enemies. Absolutely to give no quarter under any conditions. So all you people out there that are maybe want to be listening to this, that we're anti-Jew and all that, and well, let me tell you something. Lone wolves are all around you, no matter where you go. The lunch counter, the restaurant, your club, lodges, your work. There's growing numbers of lone wolves out there, and they're just going to smile at you, pat you on the back until the right time. Well, let's have a little discourse on race. When we merge our bodies with another human being and then move on, we think that the person is gone forever, but on a microbiological level, there are numerous complex, processes taking place which may indicate that your connection is permanent, lasting forever. For example, a recent study showed that after a mother carries a child in her body, some of the child's cells remain inside the mother for life. So if this occurs when carrying a baby inside your body, what about carrying a man's seed inside your womb? We've been talking about this for a long time. A new study is claiming that sleeping with a person may lead to permanent connections that could actually cause your children to share genetic traits that are consistent with an ex-lover. Now, the racial struggle's been talking about this for decades. I remember talking about it clear back in the 70s. A study at the University of South Wales found that the process of telogony, where traits of past lovers are passed into future children, holds in fruit flies. In case you wanted to know why geneticists love to study fruit flies, it's because the genetic structure of these little creatures is highly complementary to humans. In fact, the fruit flies contain 75% of the genes that lead to disease within human beings. Scientists claim that for fruit flies, the size of the child matched the size of the first male that the mother mated with, not the actual biological father. They believe that this occurred because molecules of the first father's seed were absorbed by the mother's egg and never left her body. See, now, if you're dating a woman that's had sex with a nigger or any other kind of non-acceptable, then this is what you're looking at, and you guys better figure this out. You better get a private detective on this. So when these eggs were later fertilized by another man, the first man's influence was still being felt inside the mother's body. Maybe this is why you get a chill down your spine when your ex-boyfriend walks into the room. Quote, "We don't know yet whether this applies to other species," unquote, said the author of the study, Dr. Angela Crean. "It may not apply, but it definitely gives us all something to think about. The most interesting activity in the universe typically occurs at the molecular level. Think about this when you let the creepy old guy inside your body. He may be giving you the gift that keeps on giving." Information, let's see here, read more via your baby, looks like your ex. Shocking new research shows previous partner's sperm may lurk inside you. So there you go. There you go, boys and girls. Better watch it. You guys better watch who you lay with, which women you lay with, because you may inadvertently be causing an interracial type degeneracy in your child. Now, if you want to check that out, go to themedicalblog.com, and that's where you'll find that article. And there's a whole lot of comments from blacks on there. Really pisses them off, scares the shit out of them, because they know when smart white men and women understand and read that, they're going to be less likely to bed down on these Saturday night special deals. And beware of these mulatto women that you see running all around that don't look like traditional ape-looking black Africans, but have quite a bit of white blood in them. They're getting operations on their eyes to change their eye color, which may lead to some really bad racial mistakes, especially in a bar late at night. Well, is this the work of a lone wolf white or a lone wolf black? Or the black KKK? You don't expect on any day for a pastor to be the victim of gun violence, even though I think they should. But the city of Memphis Tennessee has an entire history of frightening activity in the church community. Pastor Don Smith, black 57-year-old pastor of the Prospect Park Baptist Church, you know, among the blacks, they're all preachers, just like the Jews are all rabbis. Anyhow, he was found dead in a pond on Saturday morning. According to the medical examiner, the pastor died from a gunshot wound. Smith's family said that they have no idea what happened. He was known as a good pastor and a good man, so this was a surprise to their family. The pastor's body was found by two men walking their dogs. By the time the paramedics arrived, the preacher had been deceased for quite some time. The church is shocked, and many of its members are speaking out about the tragedy on the social media. Well, start checking the other people in the church first, especially other women who he probably was screwing on the side, and some gal, Frankie, you know. Frankie got her purse out, pulled out her .44 and let him have it and shoved him in the pond, man. I'll bet you anything, whoever killed this guy was in the church. Those Christians are pretty dangerous, you know. Anybody would believe what they believe is pretty screwed up. Maybe whoever shot him, one of the church members, women, must have thought, well, maybe he's like Lazarus. He'll rise from the dead, man. Well, boys and girls, that's it for Wotan's Day. Yeah, the 5th of November, 2014. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Wait a minute. No, there'll be some shows out of our archives for the next 4 days. So just giving you a little warning there, and I'll be back with a live show on next Tuesday. But in the meantime, keep your pie holes shut, and I have nothing to say.